democracy that was supposed to give voice to a broad cross-section of society is perceived in many of these countries as being captured by some elites and technocrats and not really increasing the voice of the people that are now turning against it.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. It's been 2 years since VoxDev launched, and that's been a period of rapid global change in economics and politics. So we're asking some economists and policymakers about the economic events of the last 2 years and what they think is having the most important impact on developing countries. So we're delighted to welcome today Daron Osamoglu, who joins us from MIT. Daron, welcome to VoxDev Talks.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here.
What do you think has been the most important economic event, Daron?
Well, I think the most important trend that was already apparent in 2016 and before, but has gained momentum since then, is the slide of democratic and broadly inclusive institutions back into authoritarianism, non-democratic regimes, and so on in the developing world. To be sure, this is not confined to the developing world. We have seen the same currents affect the more developed part of the world economy, most notably the United States. But I think the current landscape for developing countries has become very treacherous with the rise of a very different type of threat to the institutional infrastructure that has the promise of undergirding shared prosperity in these economies.
Is this something that's just happening the last 2 years, though? I mean, we could even argue that democracy's unusual in the long run rather than authoritarianism.
Well, that's a very interesting question and a long debate. But let me first bite the small piece that I might have at least a fighting chance of chewing, which is that no, it hasn't started in the last 2 years. If you look at broadly reliable democracy indices, you see this trend going on since about 2009, 2010. So democracy is not a panacea. It's what we call democracies are often mired with corruption, clientelistic practices, or non-democratic practices that prevent people's civil rights and political rights. But still, it's a good check on what's going on with institutions around the world. And what the political scientist Samuel Huntington had called the third wave of democracy that started sometime around the 1970s meant that from the 1970s to the late 2000s, pretty much every year there were more countries improving their democracy scores or transitioning from non-democratic regimes to democratic regimes than the other way around. Since around 2009, 2010, that trend has reversed. But interestingly, the nature of these non-democratic regimes mm-hmm. is quite different. Clearly, Jair Bolsonaro's election in Brazil is a turning point in some sense, because that's one of the very vibrant democracies that was having a variety of problems over the last decade or more. And it's really been a sea change for Brazil 2.5 decades after the end of the military tutelage. But you see the same thing in Turkey with Erdogan. You see the same thing with Duterte, again, a little bit before the two-year window that we're talking about in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. You see the same thing in Hungary and Poland. And in some different form, of course, with Chavez in Venezuela, where we're seeing the last chapter of that. What's very interesting, if you look at the 1960s and the 1970s, the threat to democracy came from gentlemen wearing jackboots representing the army, using the monopoly of the violence or something close to the monopoly of the violence that the armed forces had in many of these countries, forcefully overthrowing democratic regimes and often allied with landed interests and the most regressive parts of the economic elites of these countries. And Latin America, of course, and the Philippines are no stranger to this, neither is Turkey. But the new threat to democracy is coming from a different place, and it's exploiting different problems in the way that democracy functions, perhaps bringing us closer to your question of whether democracy is the unusual, fluky thing that has happened. First of all, almost all of these leaders are coming to power through some combination of democratic means. Mm-hmm. They're being elected and they're being elected by championing the rights and grievances of some subset of the population and claiming to fix the political system. And typically, they get part of their legitimacy from being elected. So they are much more reluctant to sending the army and saying, we're going to rule by decree, whatever the people say. And also, the way that I think they have emerged is precisely because of the promises that democratic governance and the broadly market-based institutions that have gone with it over the last 3-4 decades haven't really been realized. So they are building on discontent because growth has not been shared. There have been many segments of the population that have been left behind. But even more tellingly, democracy that was supposed to give voice to a broad cross-section of society is perceived in many of these countries as being captured by some elites and technocrats and not really increasing the voice of the people that are now turning against it.
There's been a lot of work in the last couple of years about whether democracy is good for growth and whether it's good for inclusive growth. What's your opinion on this work?
There has been a lot of work over the last 3 decades on this. And it's actually a strange area, I must say, for a couple of reasons. The first one is that it is of critical importance for how we think about the importance and role of different types of political institutions. But despite that, if I may say so, hopefully this won't get me into too much trouble, it's been characterized by really shoddy work. And funny enough, despite that, it sort of became almost a conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
Based on that sort of shoddy work, that democracy is not good for growth, at best neutral, perhaps bad. There are two sort of lines of work that have undergirded this conclusion. One was empirical work by Robert Barrow, but this was based on kitchen sink cross-country regressions, which ended up comparing not apples to oranges, but apples to, you know, monkeys or something. If you put a cross-country regression and then you have China there, that's not democratic, but growing very rapidly, and then you have Belgium that's democratic and growing nowhere near the growth rate of China, or you have Bangladesh that's more democratic and it's not growing anywhere close to China. And then put democracy on the right-hand side, most of the time you're going to see, well, democracy is not that good for economic growth. But that's really not distinguishing whether the reason why China is growing is a host of other global and country-specific factors, such as starting from very low level of income with relatively high state capacity, relatively high level of human capital, and then integrating it quite successfully into the world global value chain, versus other political problems that exist in these countries and would have existed regardless of whether they are democratic or not. So I think it's an interpretable inference problem. And then on the side, there was a sort of a large political science literature. And some of those papers also either didn't really go beyond cross-country regressions, or when they used different methodologies, they weren't very systematic. So on the whole, the results were close to inconclusive. But if anything, because of the preponderance of these cross-country regressions in there, more towards, well, democracy is not that good for economic growth, just like Barrow's regressions.
So what empirical work have you been doing in this area?
Work that I have done with Suresh Naidu, Pascual Restrepo, and James Robinson started from a number of methodological and data premises. The better works in the previous literature were drowned, and they didn't do all of the things that needed to be done. So they were going very much in the right direction. So we started with a much better measure of democracy using multiple sources. That's important because it takes out a lot of measurement error that creates problems, and it's not the most important factor, but that's useful. Second, we completely gave up on pure cross-country comparisons. So the question is always, if a country democratizes or reverses its democracy, what happens to its growth trajectory? So that's a much more of a within-country comparison. It's not a panacea, of course, because changes in democracy may be endogenous. They may happen together with other factors that may have an impact. But it's actually a very important econometric problem that the previous literature, especially in political science, didn't really tackle. Because countries don't democratize at random points, there are important dynamics in their economic outcomes that will interfere with appropriate inference. So let me be a little bit more specific on this. So essentially, if you look at the data, what you see is that there's a very strong tendency for countries to democratize when the previous autocratic regime get into economic crisis. Because crises don't resolve themselves in 6 months or a year, when you have become democratic, you're still in the midst of an economic crisis. So if you compare the first few years of a democracy to the last 20 years, you're going to conclude, now for different reasons than the apples-oranges comparison, oh, democracy is not doing that well. But that's not the right thing to do either. The right thing to do from an econometric point of view is to estimate the dynamics of whatever variable you care about, let's say GDP per capita, so that you sort of capture that dip and then recovery from that dip. And then, of course, ideally, you would also want to isolate exogenous factors, and then you would also want to control for other countervailing changes or other changes that are happening that might interfere with your right inference. But to cut a long story short, once you do even a subset of these things, the conclusion becomes very clear and extremely robust. Actually, democracy is very good for economic growth. And it doesn't depend on much on whether the country is low education, low GDP, agricultural, or anything. There is no evidence that some countries are not ready for democracy, therefore their economic growth is going to be harmed. As a ballpark figure, if you democratize, you get about 20 to 25% higher GDP per capita in the next 20 years. Not something that's going to transform Nigeria into Switzerland, but a huge change nonetheless. This also doesn't say democracy is easy, that it doesn't say democracy won't create discontent, but it does point out that democracy is really an important institutional foundation for economic growth, and in fact, it turns out for shared economic growth. And whenever it is being threatened, we should not be so cavalier about it.
Can you tell me a little bit about shared economic growth, the distributional impacts?
Okay, that's super interesting in my opinion. So let me first ask the question slightly differently. Why does democracy grow more? And the answer is, and this already gives you some clues about the shared prosperity, because democracies tax more. So goodbye to the low tax paradise view of the economic growth. They invest more in education. They invest more in health. And they modestly increase investment. And they also reform more. They get rid of a lot of monopolies, financial restrictions, product market restrictions. It's the combination of all of these things. And therefore, they clearly create the foundations of shared prosperity with greater education, better health provided to the poorer segments of the population. But, and this might come as a surprise, despite greater taxation, greater investment in all of these things, greater growth, inequality doesn't change all that much. And why is that? Because together with growth comes new opportunities, and those new opportunities are unequally exploited too. Think of South Africa. If there is any democracy that has improved unequally distributed economic opportunities, it is South Africa with the collapse of apartheid in 1994. 90% of the population were excluded from not just political voice, but from most of the vibrant economic sectors of the country. But, you know, what happens is that once you provide those opportunities to the black middle class, some people do very well. Actually, inequality didn't decline. It's actually probably increased in South Africa since 1994. Of course, there are other factors, you know, corruption increased, especially over Zuma's term, and there were other institutional failures in South Africa. It's been not an idyllic democracy, but it sort of illustrates that democracy itself is not a panacea that's going to reduce inequality by itself.
Can we look at this the other way around? Does inequality prove a threat to democracy?
I think it does. I think it's one of the factors. I don't think that moderate increases in inequality immediately start threatening democracy. Look, inequality has increased, especially, you know, top income inequality has increased even in Scandinavia, but we don't think that Norway and Sweden are suddenly at the risk of having their democracies reversed. But if inequality reaches alarming proportions, where all of the resources of a country are monopolized by a small segment, that's of course not going to be consistent with democracy for two reasons. And it's the combination of these two reasons that are really, I think, the biggest threat. First, because democracy is promising greater equality to people. It's giving political voice to everybody, one person, one vote. But if on top of it, then you say it's one person, one vote, but all of the wealth goes to 10 families, that's not going to be a stable situation. But combine this with another factor, which is that if wealth, income, and power become so concentrated, people are going to start using them to monopolize both political power and economic benefit. Seeing that in many developing countries where formal sector jobs, educational opportunities, prestige, political voice, all of these things become monopolized by a segment of the population, especially if inequality runs uncontrolled.
Can China keep lifting people out of poverty without becoming more democratic?
I don't think so. But to be honest, we don't know. And the reason is because if you look at history, the answer is no. There is no example in history of a country that has achieved sustained innovation-based, productivity-based economic growth for long periods of time based on an autocratic system that's very tightly controlled. You've had bursts of growth. For example, Russia in the 19th century or Soviet Union under Stalin, where the mighty hand of the state is used for channeling resources, albeit inefficiently, from one activity to another. But it's been short-lived, partly because this sort of top-down allocation without sort of bottom-up experimentation and innovation-driven growth is unsustainable and highly inefficient. And those inefficiencies and running out of productivity improvements have become one of the biggest barriers to continued growth, and the political tensions that it creates have not helped.
Darren, with this new generation of autocrats that you've described who are elected into office, if we think they are destructive for a country's growth, there is a limited policy response to it, isn't there? Any response to undermine that is democratically illegitimate by definition.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's part of the issue. These autocratic leaders are very good at using the cover of democracy while also distorting it. So Maduro in Venezuela sends the army onto the streets and kills protesters, but at the same time, he still claims to be democratically elected. Erdogan in Turkey lost the three biggest cities, but annulled one of the elections. That is really creating a very difficult response possibility for democratic forces. Clearly, the mistake would be to fight the Democrat with force. That is both unstable. It would lead to a lot of bloodshed and chaos, but it would also cement the view among the supporters of leaders with populist appeal. And those leaders' support will become more cemented and stronger as a result of an action like that, and that would definitely backfire.
Looking ahead to the next 2 years, maybe the next 20 years, are you optimistic or pessimistic about this trend?
It's a hard question. I don't know. I mean, if you had asked me 10 years ago, I would say I am cautiously optimistic that I realize from my research from history that the path of democracy is never clear. It's always going to be contested. There are problems coming from the outside, people wanting to undermine democracy, and inside, the instability, the hurly-burly of politics that democracy creates, all of these are going to be difficult barriers, and generating democracy in places where it didn't exist, such as in the Middle East, for example, is a really tall order, as the Arab Spring's failure everywhere pretty much except Tunisia demonstrates. You know, I think there are still things to be optimistic about. Many more countries have people involved, interested in politics and not willing to just sit in their corner and listen to what the generals are willing to tell them. But on the other hand, I think the grievances that have built up and the perception that the economy is rigged in favor of global elites, in favor of this group or that group, And moreover, people have been, their voices, their grievances have been trivialized, is really creating a very dangerous environment for these types of leaders to emerge. So I think it's really a call for us to find a way of improving both the market economy and the functioning of democracy in the developing world so that we can actually confront these challenges.
Daron, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Tim. Thank you.
This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you want to hear more in this series, or indeed any of our Vox Dev Talks from the past 2 years, subscribe on your podcast platform or visit voxdev.org.